Welcome to the New In Chess podcast. You're listening to a story from the Essential Sesonko, collected portraits and tales of a bygone chess era by Grandmaster Genna Sesonko. Since the 1980s, he has written extensively for New In Chess magazine. Sesonko's chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. Today's episode is about Tigran Petrosyan. Tigran Petrosyan was born in Tbilisi to Armenian parents but moved to Moscow at age 20. Becoming the ninth world chess champion made Ayan Tigran a hero in Armenia. Petrosyan died in 1984 at the age of 55, never having seen the end of the Soviet Union. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy, from the Essential Sesonko, Chapter 34, Tigran Petrosyan.
Tigran Petrosyan, 1929 to 1984. The main thing is happiness. When the deputy head of the Soviet Sport Committee, Viktor Ivonin, who was in charge of chess, was reporting to the top about Petrosyan's defeat in his match against Fischer, one of the reasons he gave was the presence of a huge Armenian colony in Buenos Aires that had distracted the Soviet grandmaster from his play. The main reason for his crushing defeat by the American, 6.5 to 2.5, was something else, of course, but it was certainly a fact that wherever Petrosyan played, the attention of his compatriots was riveted on him. At the tournament in Lone Pine, quite a few Armenians who lived in California came to see him, and in other countries I always saw Petrosyan's fellow countrymen coming to try and talk to their idol, or just to shake his hand. When the Soviet team arrived in Buenos Aires in 1954, hundreds of people met them at the airport, chanting, "Petrosyan, Petrosyan!" In Montevideo, Uruguay, local Armenians gave a dinner in their club, named after Marshal Bagramian, a hero of the Second World War. The dinner was given in honour of the Soviet team, but the star guest was Tigran Petrosyan. But no matter how popular Petrosyan was abroad, nothing could compare with the attention he got at home. When he came to Yerevan, it was a national event. Receptions with the city fathers, television appearances, requests for interviews, gifts and tributes, banquets and parties, delegations from the remotest corners of the Republic. A luxury suite was always reserved for Petrosyan in the best hotel, the Armenia. Mark Taimanov recalls how at breakfast the doors of the restaurant flew open and a colourful group of old men in national costumes slowly paraded to Petrosyan's table. Bowing, they deferentially addressed Petrosyan in Armenian. After the delegation had left, Tigran explained, "Those were elders from a small mountain village. They came to find out how many checks you have to give for perpetual check, how many queens you can have on the board, and whether a player whose king has reached the 8th rank gets an extra pawn." Who, other than Tigran Petrosyan, could give the answers to these difficult questions? But it wasn't just about the questions. This was an act of admiration and love for their compatriot, who had become the best in the world in his field. Yerevan, 1962, the opera house, where a famous tenor is performing the role of Canio in Leoncavallo's Pagliacci, the hall is full. The conductor comes out to the applause of the crowd. The lights go down, music is heard. The overture has been played, the curtain has risen. But suddenly the orchestra falls silent at a wave from the conductor's baton, and all the chandeliers in the hall light up. What's happened? Petrosyan and his wife appear at the door. Mark Taimanov was also at that show. The whole audience leapt from their seats and burst into an ovation, and it was only after Tigran had been ceremonially accompanied to his box that the conductor gave a signal to the orchestra and the performance started up again. During Petrosian's World Championship matches with Botvinnik and twice with Spassky, 1963-69, the Estrada Theatre in Moscow was full of hundreds of Armenians, not only those who lived in the capital, but also people who had come from further away. When they arrived in Moscow, going to see their idol was the first thing they did, although many had a very vague idea about chess. The most excited ones scattered rose petals in front of him and soil that they had brought from Ekmeadzin, the ancient religious centre of Armenia. Harry Golombek, the assistant arbiter, wrote that during one of the games, a deafening applause broke out after Petrosian's move, and a group of Armenians rushed to the stage. Employees blocked their way, but an elderly man managed to break through anyway and grab Petrosian's hand. You could always see a large number of Armenian fans in front of the entrance to the theatre, eagerly awaiting news about the course of the battle, and a huge demonstration board was put up in the centre of Yerevan. At that time, Petrosian received a telegram from Armenian football fans. "We don't mind our team Ararat losing, as long as you win." After defeating Botvinnik and becoming world champion, Petrosian, extracting the mask of a simple bloke from his rich, imitative repertoire, usually told an Armenian parable about Tsar Nazar. Nazar was weak and timid, and not a shining intellect, but despite all that, he became the Tsar. Then he invited his loser friends to his palace and hosted them luxuriously. When they started trying to find out how he'd managed to surpass them all, Nazar replied, "The main thing is happiness." Petrosian received 2,000 rubles for his victory over Botvinnik. Peanuts in comparison with the prizes for world championship matches today, but a decent amount in those days by the standards of the Soviet Union, where the average salary was about 100 rubles a month. But his biggest gift came from his compatriots. At the closing ceremony of the match itself, they presented the new world champion with the keys to a Volga car. Petrosian's Georgian admirers also considered Tigran one of their own, as he was born in Tbilisi and achieved his first successes in Georgia. "That kind of present we can't do," they admitted, and gave Petrosian a classic canvas of Armenian paintings by Martiros Sarian. "Now, this picture is worth more than any Mercedes," says Misha, Tigran Vatanovich's oldest son, half a century later. When Petrosian was playing his first match with Spassky, 1966, we went home together after a couple of games. "We were going the same way," Yakov Neistat recalls. "Every time, we were followed at a respectful distance by a crowd of Armenians. Once we went up to a newspaper kiosk, unlike Botvinnik, who never read the press during competitions, Petrosian loved to look at what they were writing about him in the papers. Tigran had already walked away from the kiosk, but I stayed there for a moment, glancing at the cover of some magazine."
What did he say?"
a young man exclaimed excitedly, separating from the crowd that had accompanied us. When he returned from Yerevan after winning the title of world champion, Petrosian said, "You realize I could be a tsar here. You can imagine, in the villages, they kiss my hand." Of course, this attitude couldn't leave him indifferent, but although Petrosian said more than once that he did everything to make his fellow countrymen happy, he didn't react to the hypertrophied signs of attention without irony. His own story about returning to Moscow after a few days in Yerevan, he told to Neistat,
"Early morning, a cavalcade of 4 or 5 cars, each of them is full of presents.
I'm in the first car, with the second secretary of the Central Committee. Suddenly he asks, 'Are you taking some lamb with you?'
Lamb? No.
The secretary, 'You can't go without lamb, and don't refuse.' He gives a signal. All the cars turn off the road. It's early, the market has only just opened, but there are already customers. The doors fly open instantly, and the managers of the market spill out and greet their dear guests. The meat pavilion. The secretary himself chooses a carcass and orders the best pieces to be cut off. The queue, which has been pushed back by the important guest, forms again closer to the counter. Behind me, I hear someone say, "Can't you cut something off the same piece for me?" "I'll cut you some of the same piece," the vendor replies, "when you get good at chess." At the age of 16, Tigran moved from Tbilisi to Yerevan and lived there for almost 4 years. An Armenian coming to Armenia from Tbilisi. He's ours, our Tigran, of course, but still, it isn't easy to explain this. The ways of the East are mysterious, as we know. Petrosian began his second World Championship match with Spassky in 1969 with a win, but then he started going into a tailspin. The score became equal, and after the 17th game, the challenger came out ahead and wasn't giving up his lead anymore. It was then that the Armenian radio, footnote, a popular type of joke in Soviet times, hiding behind this fictional radio station, people vented criticism on everyday life in their country, end footnote. It was then that the Armenian radio began to speak about the world champion's play with descending admiration. The brilliant Armenian chess player, Grandmaster Tigran Petrosian, the talented Soviet Grandmaster T. Petrosian, the graduate of the Tbilisi Chess School, Petrosian. But that was just a joke, of course. Even after losing the match to Spassky, every visit to Yerevan by Petrosian was still an event. It was clear that a man was visiting who had become one of the symbols of the small nation, two-thirds of whom lived outside the borders of Armenia. It was typical that when Petrosian was accused of playing defensively, above all trying not to lose, he associated this with the difficult, very bloody events in the history of his country, replying that safety was an Armenian national trait. Remembering his youth in Tbilisi, I once asked him, "Do you speak Georgian, Tigran Vatanovich?" "Not all that much, but I can explain myself with a girl," was his surprising reply. Perhaps when he was young, Petrosian did make some mistakes in his Russian, but when I got to know him better, he spoke absolutely correctly. So the joke that I heard from Korshnoi, "I calls you, you wasn't home," as Petrosian would have said, didn't fully correspond with reality. Petrosian played in Yugoslavia dozens of times, a chess paradise back then, and he read Serbo-Croat fluently and spoke it decently, like almost all Soviet grandmasters. His English consisted of several everyday expressions and words, just like his German and Spanish, but a capable person, guessing what was being talked about, he used them skillfully. "Mucho, mucho trabajo," Petrosian repeated after his game with Fernandez at the tournament in Las Palmas in 1980, explaining to the Spaniard what significant technical difficulties he would have had to overcome if the latter had played differently. But he immediately agreed with his vanquished opponent that his, Petrosian's, posición remained mejor, mucho mejor.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Although Petrosian had a flat in Moscow, he spent most of his time at his dacha in the suburb of Rastri, where he was visited by Armenians who lived in Moscow or who were visiting from Armenia. His closest friend was the composer Arno Babajanian. During his World Championship matches, Babajanian, smoking nervously, walked around the theatre in circles, inquiring from time to time how Tigran was doing. As it was, the composer didn't bring Petrosian much luck, as he often lost when his friend found time to come and watch him. They were both excitable people, and they often squabbled over a game of backgammon, which Petrosian was keen on. The score was roughly equal, but each insisted that he was the stronger player. Sometimes, to break a run of bad luck, Petrosian rolled the dice from under his knee. Undoubtedly, he had seen this when he was still a boy in Tbilisi, and brought both that backward swing and his passion for food into his later life. He loved kebabs and Armenian cheeses, but he also adored Georgian dishes, lobio and satsiva. His wife learned to cook these wonderfully. A joke went around Moscow when Petrosian was playing his match with Botvinnik. What's more important for winning the top title in chess? Being a Jew married to Armenian, Gayan Davidovna Botvinnik, née Ananova, or an Armenian married to a Jew, Rona Yakovlevna Petrosian, née Avineza? 2 decades later, Garry Kimovich Kasparov put an end to the argument, finding a winning combination in his own person. And today, Levon Aronian confirms the success of the mix. Petrosian himself responded to these kinds of jokes with his characteristic humour. In the early 80s, when Kasparov's star was already rising, he held a training session at his own dacha with Yosef Dorfman and Alexander Belyavsky. Once Vartan, Petrosian's youngest son, came into the room where we were working and started having a lively discussion about something with his father. Dorfman recalls, when the door was closed behind him, Tigran Vartanovich shook his head. Oh yes, the Armenian-Jewish combination doesn't always produce a genius. After the Winter Olympics in Moscow in 1964, a big government reception was held. The world chess champion was among the invited guests. The secretary of the Italian Communist Party, Luigi Longo, who was on a visit to the Soviet Union, wanted to meet Petrosian and turned to Khrushchev. Khrushchev reacted to the Italian's request simply. He asked Mikoyan. Footnote: Anastas Ivanovich Mikoyan, 1895-1978, the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. End footnote. He asked Mikoyan, also an Armenian, to introduce Longo to the famous chess player. When they had begun a conversation, Khrushchev came over to them. Ah, you're that Petrosian. Listen, why is your compatriot going all over Moscow with a boom-boom to people's heads? A certain Ionesian, an Armenian, one of the first serial killers in the Soviet Union, posing as a representative of Morgaz, the Moscow gas company, had killed those who opened their doors to him and robbed their flats. And unimaginable rumours were flying around Moscow. History is silent on what Petrosian said in reply to the leader of the Soviet Union, but we can imagine how pleasant it was for him to hear Khrushchev's joke. Rona Petrosian recalls, I don't remember exactly when this was, but once, when we were at Mikoyan's, there was a discussion about Kotov's newly published book on Aliekhin. In glorifying Aliekhin, Kotov was very free with the facts, and Tigran remarked to Mikoyan that no one doubted Aliekhin's genius as a chess player, but that he was an émigré who had betrayed his country, and that Aliekhin's human qualities were extremely far from ideal. And that, for him, Petrosian, it was simply unpleasant to read this book, in which the truth only made a fleeting appearance. Mikoyan interrupted him sharply. Listen to me carefully, Tigran. Don't tell anyone what you just said to me, and be sure to mark my words. This is their country. You understand? This is their country. The country in which Tigran Petrosian lived his entire life ceased to exist in 1991. How would Petrosian have felt if he'd managed to live until today? Obviously, he wouldn't have had any everyday problems. That isn't what I'm talking about. But how would his fate have turned out? How would he have reacted to the freedom that turned out to be both better and worse than people had thought? Would he have started giving his lectures in the Moscow club that now bears his name? These were lessons of the highest class, teaching the most difficult thing in chess, how to think, to think about why you're making this or that move. From these published lectures, even today, you can follow the workings of the thought processes of a chess player in whose games you can learn what you can't learn from anyone else. Or perhaps he would have been a chess patron. Would he have been a frequent guest in independent Armenia, one of the strongest chess countries in the world today? Would he have moved there permanently, spending his last years in a halo of admiration and glory? Or would he have travelled around the towns and villages in the capacity of an ambassador, as Spassky does? Would he have started writing down his reminiscences? What would his memoirs be like? Would they only have touched on the facade of the huge building of Soviet chess, like Averbakh's, trying to avoid all the sharp corners? Would he have veered off into a cheerful, invented narrative like Taimanov? Would he have been like the uncompromising spirit fighter Bronstein, offended by the whole chess world? Or, like the furious Korchnoi, would he have distributed slaps in the face to everyone who, in his opinion, deserved them? What would he, who in the 70s of the last century called the new generation the children of chess informant, have called the young players today friends of Fritz, Ribka food? Would he have stayed in chess at all? Or like a retired Roman emperor, would he have taken up cabbage growing, living permanently at his lovely dacha? He did say, if they paid me the same salary, I'd give up chess and become a gardener. Shutting himself off from the world, would he start doing what, by his own admission, he loved most of all? Pottering about in his garden every day, sitting in the sunshine, growing flowers? We can't know that. Tigran Vartanovich Petrosian died on August 13, 1984, 8 months after he had been harshly diagnosed. As was normal in those days in the Soviet Union, he was told it was kidney stones, and they operated 3 times on inoperable cancer. 6 months before he died, he played in the Interpolis tournament in Holland and often took walks on the streets of Tilburg, talking about this and that. He particularly liked these walks where he'd beaten me on the latest occasion, and the tension of the anticipation of a forthcoming game that always accompanied this kind of socialising was dormant. Once, he talked about euthanasia, which even then was a topic of wide discussion in Holland. In the West, you prepare for death, because a man has something to lose, Petrosian argued. That's why everything is discussed openly, and wills are written, so that a man of means can put his affairs in order. But in our country, what kind of wills can there be if a man has nothing? What are you going to leave anyone? No, this isn't just about a different attitude towards death, and the problems of pain and suffering are irrelevant here, was the strictly pragmatic explanation of the problem that Petrosian gave. It's no good, Genna, he said another time. Recently my neighbour's dog bit me at my dacha. It's a bad sign. A dog won't bite a healthy person. What are you saying, Tigran Vartanovich? What's some dog got to do with anything? It wasn't some dog, it was the neighbour's, a dog that knew me well. No, a dog won't bite a healthy person, especially not someone it knows, and he shook his head. He was buried in the Armenian cemetery in Moscow. At the last minute, they decided to put a chess set into the coffin. The idea came up spontaneously. No one had one handy, and they found the first set they could get hold of. On the third day, the grave was opened, and the chess set had disappeared from the grave. The thieves had thought that the pieces were made of gold.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.